He fell from the 9th floor. He hanged himself. He slipped on a piece of soap while washing. He hanged himself. He slipped on a piece of soap while washing. He fell from the 9th floor. He hanged himself while washing. He slipped from the 9th floor. He hung from the 9th floor. He slipped on the 9th floor while washing. He fell from a piece of soap while slipping. He hung from the 9th floor. He washed from the 9th floor while slipping. He hung from a piece of soap while washing. Welcome to Daring Dissent, where we uplift stories of remarkable resistance throughout history. I'm your host, historian and teacher Jeff DeMoss. Today's episode focuses on South African anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko. We'll discover how the freedom movement was much more than just Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress. We'll also dive into the psychology of oppression by exploring the roots of the Black Consciousness Movement. The opening poem that you heard is titled In Detention by Chris Van Vick. We'll revisit this famous resistance poem later in the episode, and its descent into unintelligible nonsense will strangely make sense to you by then. We're going to zoom in today on one specific chapter of resistance to the policy of apartheid. In order to do that, we need at least a cursory knowledge of what apartheid was and how it works. So I'm going to give you just a little bit of background, and then we'll dive really into focusing just on the story of Steve Biko and the Black Consciousness Movement. So if we go back to the 17th century, we'll find Dutch settlers, who were known as Afrikaners, are going to first come to South Africa during that time. Then the British are going to come later and establish colonial rule throughout the 19th and early 20th century. So if you're really unfamiliar with the history and makeup of South Africa, it's a country that has, for centuries, white settlers that come in largely from the Netherlands and from the UK. A technically independent South African constitution is going to be written in 1948 when they gain their independence, technically, from the British. And that's going to formally establish what we call an apartheid state. The language of those Dutch settlers, the Afrikaners, is called Afrikaans. And the word apartheid literally translates to apartness in Afrikaans. And what happens is in 1948, when the British are going to leave formal control of the country, we're going to see the Afrikaner-led National Party take over the government, and they're going to put complete power in the hands of the descendants of those Dutch and British settlers, white people. And you're going to find that many of the racist customs that come along with apartheid, the actual laws that are there, existed before 1948. But this policy that happens when independence happens is going to formally codify all these different racist policies into law. So here's the basic setup of what apartheid is. They separate the country into four different categories. You are either white, colored, Indian or Asian, or black. And the category of being black would transition from sometimes being called black or native or Bantu, or sometimes referred to by specific ethnicities like Zulu or Xhosa. But what we're talking about is we're talking about 68% of the country being black, about 19% being white, and then 9% being colored. For those of you that are American, colored at this time would have been a term that refers to just African-Americans as a whole. However, colored in South Africa means mixed race, means someone who's mixed race and one of those races is black. Then the Indian Asian population are immigrants that came in. And essentially the way that this is going to be set up is that we're going to see the system be set up where the whites are at the top and the other three groups are at the very, very, very bottom. It's not like there's a hierarchy where we see huge delineations between the four groups. The worst of the worst is certainly going to be reserved for the black population. However, we're talking about still significant discrimination against people that are labeled as colored or Indian or Asian. Just a quick word about my language choice for this episode. As a white American, I would never refer to African Americans or black people as blacks or the blacks. It just comes off, it's got a very negative connotation to it. It comes off harsh in a lot of different ways, just wouldn't be politically correct. However, when we're talking about blacks as a racial category in apartheid era South Africa, it makes sense to refer to blacks as a category of people. So I just want to be clear and open about my language choice. The other pieces I want to be clear in my language, we're going to see the Black Consciousness Movement, which we're going to explore, is going to openly denounce the use of the word non-white. They are going to embrace unity among people of color in South Africa, colored people, Indians, Asians, and Black people all together in a common experience. And they explicitly denounce the use of the term non-white to try to say that we should only be defined by the fact that we're not white. Speaking of language, I just want to give you a little bit of cultural understanding for the country. The most commonly spoken languages in the country at this time are Zulu and Xhosa, which are two of the most common native African languages in Southern Africa as a whole, and also are the two largest Black ethnic groups at that time. But English and Afrikaans were the languages of education and government as part of this apartheid system as a whole. There's a million things that we could dive into for what apartheid actually looked like in practice and what this system of segregation was. But I'm going to try to keep it simple for us and give us just a few benchmarks that we can point to for how apartheid was actually enforced in the country. It looks very similar to Jim Crow laws in the South of the United States. So what the National Party did in charge of apartheid was they claimed that they were advocating for, you know, separate development of the different racial groups in South Africa. And what they mean by that is segregation, the full-blown segregation of all public spaces, and in many ways, private spaces. We're going to see Black people and people of color as a whole be forced to live in certain areas, be prevented from traveling around the country or leaving the country, and have to carry around what are called passes or domestic passports at the time, and they could be stopped and frequently harassed by security forces or the police trying to prevent them from being able to travel to different places. If you were Black in apartheid era South Africa, let's say in the 1970s, you cannot be in a big urban area for more than 72 hours at a time. It's called the Group Areas Act. It's just one specific example of how this is going to be some extreme forms of segregation. We're going to see forced migration, where we're going to see people of color be kicked out of their homes and forced into what are called Bantustans, or essentially homelands or reservations that are going to be created to keep Black people out of the most desirable parts of the country and move them to other parts. We're going to see a complete stripping of the basic civil liberties of people who are not white in the country. We're going to see censorship of, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly. We're going to see widespread disenfranchisement. So you're not going to be able to vote if you are not white. We're going to see bans on interracial marriage, which is going to be one of the reasons why we're going to see colored people be attacked. We're going to see a radically inferior education system for those that are Black, especially, where we're going to see the resources and the time and money that is dedicated to Black schools are radically different than white schools. Then finally, we're going to see a criminal justice system where the cards are just stacked against colored people, Black people, Indian and Asian people, where the entire system is going to be designed to uphold the power of white supremacy in the country. So although we're going to see discrimination take place very heavily against colored people and Indian Asian, this episode is really going to largely focus in on the treatment of Black South Africans. Just like the people in the Black Consciousness Movement, they actually wind up using the term Black as this all-encompassing term to refer to all the people of color that are going to face the same type of discrimination that Black people face to the extreme. So, you know, this is a podcast about resistance. What did resistance actually look like? We're going to see resistance start right away in the 1950s. And we saw many different groups and individuals try various tactics to end this evil white supremacist policy of apartheid. But we're going to turn our attention to the role of student movements in South Africa and their most famous leader, Steve Biko. Bantu Stephen Biko was born in 1946 in Ginsberg Township and the Eastern Cape of South Africa. The settlement that he was born in of around 800 people had both Black and colored people, and every four families shared a water supply and a toilet. So he grew up in a life of relative poverty. His family is Xhosa, which is the second largest ethnic group after the Zulu people, and so he grew up hearing Xhosa, Afrikaans, and English all spoken in his neighborhood. In this episode, I'm going to do my best to handle the Xhosa words or the Afrikaans words that are going to come across throughout the episode, but I'm not promising perfection. I'm going to do the best that I can, all right? So apologies to those of you who are much more well-versed in those languages. I've got the ultimate nerd's dilemma of only ever having read some of these words rather than hearing people talk about them. You have to have, you know, friends who want to talk to you about history to actually hear them out loud. So his dad was in the police force before becoming a government clerk, and his dad was working towards a law degree when he died in 1950. Steve is only 4 when his dad passes away, and so he's going to be raised in a household where his mother, Alice, is really going to be the rock and foundation for the family. She was a domestic servant at a hospital in King William's Town, and she was very hardworking, and she really is going to provide a life for her children that allows them to have much bigger dreams than just what would normally be available for the children growing up in his neighborhood. Biko is the 3rd of 4 children. He had an older sister, Bukelwa, an older brother, Kaya, and a younger sister, Nobandil, which I only tell you this because together their names comprised a riddle, which is one of the weirder things I've ever heard someone do. It's really cool, though. So I'm going to do my best to try to tell you what supposedly the riddle is that his parents came up with. It's Hai Ukubukeka Kwekaya Labantu Bandileo, which translated into English means "we admire the expanded family." So within that riddle, it's, you know, like La Bantu is there, and Bantu is the actual given first name of Steve Biko. So that's a pretty cool idea. I like the idea of turning your kids' names into a riddle. Is that a riddle? Okay, whatever. His birth name is Bantu Stephen Biko, and so the word Bantu has a complicated legacy. It's the Zulu word for people. But it was also used to generically refer to black people in South Africa during apartheid, and so it develops this negative connotation in the era for some. It also broadly refers to 100 million people who live in southern and central Africa who speak a family of over 700 different languages called Bantu languages. So it's got all these different meanings. And so maybe that's one of the reasons why Bantu Stephen Biko decided to just go by Steve for most of his life. Now, the terms African or black came to be more widely embraced than Bantu in places like South Africa, as Bantu came to take on a colonial or apartheid tone. But there's also going to be some who try to reclaim the term as a term of empowerment to their roots, and maybe a term of Pan-African empowerment as well. The choice by Biko's father to give him the name Bantu is suggested by some to attribute Biko as being a person for other people. Umuntu, ngumtu, ngabanye, abantu, meaning a person is a person by means of other people. And not sure exactly how true that story is, but some have suggested that's the case. And I love that idea because it very much applies to the personality and legacy of Steve. Steve's brother said one time, "People, especially from overseas, ask me why Steve was called Bantu. They think Bantu is a derogatory, racist word, but it is Bantu with a soft B, and it means the one for the people." Our opening poet, Chris Van Vick, wrote a children's book about Biko, and he started it by saying the following. "One Sunday afternoon, a young boy walked through the streets of a township. With a book under his arm, he headed for the shade of a tree in the veld. While the other boys played in the streets, he loved to sit on his own under a tree. Here he could read about the world and its people. The young people and the old people of the township all knew who that little boy was. There goes Steve Biko with his books," they said. He got really good grades as a kid all throughout elementary school, and he graduated from his high school by the time he was 15, and his sister had the following to say. "He was not just responsible at home. He felt responsible for the community, especially for the education of the community. This is because when he passed his junior certificate, the community of Ginsburg collected money to send him to school. It was unheard of in Ginsburg, but he passed very well. He later felt so indebted that he set up an education trust for the township of Ginsburg." So he grew up as kind of this star child academically in his local community, and education was very important to him. And he's going to be admitted to Lovedale College in 1963 at the age of 15, which is this missionary school. And this school is only open to Xhosa students because of the 1959 University Education Act, which is going to segregate schools all throughout South Africa. Biko had this to say about education. The African child learns to hate his heritage in his days at school. So negative is the image of African society presented to him that he tends to find solace only in close identification with white society. Part of the approach in bringing about black consciousness has to be directed to the past, to seek to rewrite the history of the black man and to produce in it the heroes who form the core of the African background. So although Steve is growing up and he's not very political, he's recognizing in his education very early on that he's getting a fundamentally different experience than his white peers that are at different schools. So his brother Kaya enrolled at Lovedale just a year before him, and that's part of why he's going to go to this specific school. And what happens is that they are both going to be expelled from Lovedale for political activism. And this is going to be kind of a watershed moment for Biko. What's going to happen is that he and 50 others are going to be accused, with very little evidence, that he was a supporter of the outlawed Pan-African Congress-aligned group called POCO. And what POCO was, it was an armed wing of that Pan-African Congress, the PAC. And the PAC had broke away from the even more moderate African National Congress, who's the most famous group in resistance to apartheid led by Nelson Mandela. And so the PAC is this more radical group, and this is the armed wing of this group. And what they broke apart from the ANC about was their opposition to this kind of multiracial approach to combating apartheid, that we should be working together, black and white, side by side to combat this. So they're the more radical African nationalists. And they're an aggressively anti-white underground organization, and POCO means pure or alone in Xhosa. The group is so secretive that it's set up in a way where the members don't even know the identities of other members, and they target police for killings. Here's the problem. Steve and his brother weren't part of this group. And so part of what happens is that if anyone gets even socially connected to people that are part of resistance movements, frankly, no matter how radical they are, you're going to see security forces in South Africa step in. And when they step in, it's going to get Steve and his brother expelled from college. And when he's expelled for these ridiculous reasons, we're going to see him not just expelled, but blacklisted from all government schools. His brother Kaya had this to say. Steve was expelled for absolutely no reason at all. But in retrospect, I welcome the South African government's gesture of exposing a really good politician. I had unsuccessfully tried to get Steve interested in politics. The police were able to do in one day what had eluded me for years. This time, the great giant was awakened. Steve later said, "From that moment on, I hated authority like hell." So you see this young man have this political awakening in this moment where he's targeted in this fundamentally unfair way. And it's his first major experience of being directly attacked. And his brother goes to prison, and he's going to deliver food and supplies to him and other people that were arrested in this witch hunt. And it's going to be the beginning of a very important political career for him. In 1964, he's going to get admitted to a different college, which is this missionary school, not affiliated with the state, that he's allowed to get into despite being blacklisted from state schools. And, you know, Lovedale and St. Francis are supposed to be these progressive, liberal Christian schools. And when we use the word liberal in the context of this era, frequently what Biko and other black leaders would say when they refer to liberalism at the time is they're referring to white liberalism that is, slightly progressive, but still not going to the degree that it needs to enact real change for black people. And so Biko starts exploring the contradictions between the supposed liberal teachings of schools like Lovedale and St. Francis and the experiences of black people. Because when he got kicked out of Lovedale, they did nothing when he and his classmates were attacked on really false pretenses. And so he goes to St. Francis, he's going to graduate. And then his real political awakening happens in 1966 when he's going to go to the University of Natal's medical school for black students called Wentworth. And at the University of Natal, he is there at a school that is the only place that you could go to study medicine if you were black in the 1960s. Because back in 1959, with that University Education Act, what they did was they made it illegal for non-white students to enroll at any universities that were previously open to them. So new universities had to be established solely for people who weren't white. And we see the full segregation of universities. And what this did was this forced a bunch of the best black educators as well to flee to schools like the University of Natal. So Natal becomes this this you know, confluence of bright students and great professors that create this hub of intellectual and anti-apartheid political discourse in the town of Durban. And so they later call this the Durban moment, where we're going to see people like Biko and labor leader Richard Turner, who are going to, among the youth in Durban, turn the University of Natal and similar universities across the country eventually into this breeding ground for anti-apartheid intellectual attacks on the regime. Goes very quickly at the University of Natal, elected to a student representative council. And this is part of a broader group that is gaining traction across the country called the National Union of South African Students. I'm going to give you some different acronyms that I'm going to use throughout, and I'm going to try my best to help you keep track of them. This one we're going to refer to as NUSAS, okay? The National Union of South African Students. And this is a multiracial student group where lots of students were frustrated at not having their voices heard, and they turned to this group to help lend them a voice. And at this time, part of the broader context for you to understand is that the most important anti-apartheid political groups, the African National Congress, the PAC, are banned in 1960, and their leaders are imprisoned. Like, Mandela is in prison throughout this entire time that I'm telling you this story. And some black people responded with apathy and distance from the movement. Some historians point to the whole era that we're going to talk about with Biko as kind of like a lull in the anti-apartheid movement, and I'm going to argue that it was the opposite of that. It's this really important moment for when some of the most famous leaders of the apartheid movement are imprisoned and the most famous groups are going to be silenced and muzzled in a lot of different ways. We're going to see students step to the forefront. And people like Biko are not just inviting white people to take a step back and listen. They're calling for black people to step forward and speak and not be so dejected and silent at the pushback and muzzling of the movement in the 1960s. In 1967, Biko goes to a NUSAS conference that is hosted at Rhodes University. And what happens is, on the way there, he's talking with the other members of the student council that he's on from the University of Natal, and they're nervous that if they're going to this big city and they're going to this large white university, that you're going to see them have to experience directly very serious apartheid restrictions that are dehumanizing that they're trying to combat against. And so what happens when they show up is that Rhodes University tells NUSAS that they have to abide by the Group Areas Act, which prohibits racially mixed accommodations at this conference. And so this act forced non-whites into certain inferior areas and cities and then required them to carry passbooks to help regulate their movement, housing, education, and employment. And it specifically prohibits black people, as I told you, from being in white areas for more than 72 hours. So on the way there, Biko's group thinks like, nah, there's no way. We're going to this anti-apartheid conference. Of course, the like national chapter of this NUSAS is going to not make us abide by the Group Areas Act or you know, treat us in that dehumanizing way. And so NUSAS claimed to oppose the law, but when they show up, they tell black delegates like, hey, maybe we shouldn't directly resist this law. And if you haven't pieced it together, the leaders of this NUSAS group are white. And so a lot of the anti-apartheid groups, especially student movements in this era, are going to be led by white liberals who are critical of apartheid, but certainly not willing to go to the same levels that black people are willing to go to in this fight. And certainly they don't have the same experiences that black people do to fully understand moments like this and how dehumanizing they can be. So Biko is obviously furious about this. And so he's going to criticize the artificial integration of student politics and rails against liberalism, which refuses to take the necessary steps to create real change. And he said that they were people who were not committed to rattling the status quo, but who skillfully extracted what best suited them, quote, from the exclusive pool of white privileges. So this gets us into some of the intellectual debate that's going on during this time. And this is part of what they call the best able debate. Were white liberals the people best able to set the narrative and pace of Black resistance. So I think this is a moment for me to take some personal reflection here as a white person, as a white historian and teacher in the United States. You know, I'm not best suited to explain the Black experience and oppression for modern, you know, African Americans. Those who experience it are. That's not a reason for me as a white person to ignore or dissociate myself with the causes of people of color. It's a, you know, it's rather an invitation for me to listen and to lend support and to be an ally rather than to pretend like I have the most powerful voice or I have the most important voice, no matter how much research I can do, no matter how well versed I may be in the Black experience in the United States or in South Africa or wherever, I'm never going to actually be experiencing on a day-to-day basis. So maybe I should shut up and listen every once in a while. So this is the context in which Biko is going to, in 1968, he's going to keep meeting with others and developing the foundations for an all-Black student movement. He's just done with dealing with moments like we saw at this conference where they're not going to be able to work side by side with white people in the same way that they could in this all-Black student movement. In 1969, Biko plays an integral role in founding the South African Students Organization, SASO. It's a group we're going to talk a lot about. And students from different universities, including Natal, which played the biggest role, form this Blacks-only student organization, and he's elected president. Biko's friend Barney Pitanya said, for white liberals, quote, NUSAS was a nice, friendly club, another game you played while at university. Then you grew out of it. So they're forming, you know, not in direct opposition, like they're constantly fighting with NUSAS, but they're trying to say, we need a group that's going to fight for Black identity, for Black truth and power in this country that is run by Black people. And it's a little bit confusing because political organizations aren't really allowed to exist in the early 70s because the government has banned them. But the government sees SASO as a racially separatist group. And the main thing the government's fighting against in this era is integration. And so they very naively think that, oh, this group's trying to separate and be only for Black people. And they're not trying to work side by side with white people. Cool with us. Very dumb move from the government, as we'll see. I mean, great for those fighting against apartheid, but dumb for the government.
Any changes which are to come can only come as a result of a program worked out by Black people. And for Black people to be able to work out a program, they need to defeat the one main element in politics which was working against them. And this was a psychological feeling of inferiority.
The official ideology of SASO is Black consciousness. This is the most important political legacy of Steve Biko in South Africa as this central figure in the creation of the Black consciousness movement. And SASO is really that first big step in going down this path of creating a broader movement around this idea. So let's hear from Biko himself and let him explain what Black consciousness is. He said, it becomes clear that as long as Blacks are suffering from an inferiority complex, a result of 300 years of deliberate oppression, denigration, and derision, they will become useless co-architects of a normal society. Hence, what is necessary as a prelude to anything else that may come is a very strong grassroots buildup of Black consciousness, such that Blacks can learn to assert themselves and their rightful claim. So what Black consciousness is it's a need among the Black population of South Africa to recognize that they have been told that they are inferior their entire lives. And to develop this consciousness around the oppression that they're facing is the first step in fighting against it. And so what SASO stands for is, you know, Black consciousness is step one. And then they're talking about ending apartheid, universal suffrage, and a socialist economy. Like many Black power movements or African independence movements across Africa in the 1960s, they're going to be a socialist movement. If you've had your riches stolen from your country by colonizers, if you've had a system in the apartheid era where you're going to see racially white people are the only ones allowed to benefit from these systems of exploitive capitalism, a belief in the redistribution of wealth being a part of the solution is a very logical belief for many of them at the time. It's going to get them targeted during this Cold War era. The other thing that that SASO believes in is Black power and African humanism. And what SASO believes is that when they refer to black people. And anytime they're using that term, they're viewing that as Africans, Indians, colored people who are all suffering under apartheid and all fit under that umbrella term for them. Seeso was a little bit more of a radical group. And so Biko's going to preach that polarization and agitation were necessary steps towards change. And white liberals and white supporters of apartheid are going to respond with shock and disdain for Seeso. Let's zoom out for a second and comprehend that the Black Consciousness Movement and groups like Seeso are not just operating in a bubble here in a certain part of South Africa. They're part of a broader group of Black Power movements of the late 1960s in the U.S. and colonial independence movements across Africa. And Biko's going to be very heavily influenced by people like Stokely Carmichael, who helped radicalize the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the major student groups in the United States that were fighting against Jim Crow laws during the civil rights movement of the 60s. The Black Panther Party is going to be founded in 1966, right around the same time. And Malcolm X's words are going to resonate louder in the late 1960s than they did before. You can go back even further to the 20s with people like Marcus Garvey, who influenced Biko. And what all these people have in common, if you know anything about the history of the Black Panther Party or Malcolm X, is that white Americans largely respond with fear and false claims of victimhood when you see strong Black leaders advocate for radical change. White people freak out largely when that happens. And so white South Africans and Americans demand progress on their own terms in this era. And frankly, many white racists today demand when they see groups like the Black Lives Matter movement advocate for change in the present in the United States and beyond, they say, well, okay, that's fine. And yeah, progress can come, but tomorrow, not today. You can't take a knee. You can't protest in this specific way. You got to fit in this bubble. And so when those being oppressed call for a more rapid pace of change and embrace their own power in the movement, whites are afraid of losing control over the situation. And Biko recognizes that, and that doesn't make him be more cautious in his actions. That makes him stand out even stronger. Let's listen to a clip here from the final interview that Steve Biko ever gave later in life, where he gives his views on white liberal leadership of the anti-apartheid movement. The interviewer is not going to do the best job of setting up a perfect audio scene, as it sounds like they're in a cafe or something, but it's really cool to be able to hear from Biko himself. So let's listen.
Clearly, you see a country in which black and white can live amicably on equal terms together.
That is correct. We see a completely non-racial society. We don't believe, for instance, in the so-called guarantees for minority rights, because guaranteeing minority rights implies the recognition of portions of the community on a race basis. We believe that in our country there shall be no minority, there shall be no majority, there shall just be people. And those people will have the same status before the law, and they will have the same political rights before the law. So in a sense, it will be a completely non-racial egalitarian society.
But will the vast number of blacks, after all their experiences, yes, be able to live a life without giving vent to feelings of revenge, of...
Yes, we believe it is the duty of the vanguard political movement which brings about change to educate people's outlooks. I mean, in the same way that blacks have never lived in a socialist economic system, they're going to live to learn to live in one. In the same way that they've always lived in a racially divided society, they've got to learn to live in a non-racial society. They've got many things to learn, and all these must be brought to them and explained to the people by the vanguard movement, which is leading the revolution. So that I've got no doubt in my mind that people, and I know people in terms of my own background where I stay, are not necessarily revengeful. No, are they sadistic in outlook? Now, the black man has got no ill intentions for the white man. The black man is only incensed at the white man to the extent that he wants to entrench himself in a position of power to exploit the black man. But beyond that, nothing more. And we don't need any artificial majorities, any artificial laws to entrench ourselves in power, because we believe once we come into power, our sheer numbers will maintain us there. So we do not have the same fear that the minority white government has been having all along, which has led to these many laws, designed to keep them there.
So Biko is going to face accusations that he hated whites. And when he asked why he wasn't pushing for, you know, more gradual integration, he said, quote, "I'm against the fact that a settler minority should impose an entire system of values on an indigenous people." When groups like the Black Panther Party in the United States face similar accusations, party co-founder Bobby Seale said, quote, "We don't hate nobody because of color. We hate oppression." So Biko is not going to be someone who's going to advocate for violence against white people. He's not someone who's going to advocate for hatred towards whites. He's just recognizing the people that are best suited to lead a black resistance movement are black people themselves. He's going to be friends very famously with a man by the name of Donald Woods, who is a white man. I'm not pointing this out to say, like, you know, he's not racist because he's friends with a white man. That obviously doesn't make any sense. But I want to point out this relationship because it just tells us on a personal level that he's going to be friends and colleagues with someone who's white, where he's not going to completely dismiss the role of white people in the movement. Donald Woods is the editor of this newspaper, The Daily Dispatch, and initially he's critical of Say So and the Black Consciousness Movement for the rejection of whites. And so Biko becomes really annoyed, and what he does is he sends this woman that he's having an affair with on his wife. We'll talk about his relationship with women later on, but this woman goes by the name of Mamfela Rumfele, and she is sent to go set Woods straight. And Woods says, in his telling of the story, that this confident young woman set him straight and convinced him to reconsider the black consciousness cause. And Rumfele is not just, you know, Biko's lover, but she actually goes on to lead the Black People's Convention, which we'll talk about later, when Steve is fully banned by the government. And she later goes on to actually be the director of the World Bank. But I love the story of her being sent to go talk to Woods, and Woods is just like, oh, okay, all right, I hear what you're saying, I'm gonna hear you out. And so Woods eventually gives Steve a regular column in the Daily Dispatch, and Biko's gonna write prolifically in the Say So newsletter, and all of his writings from this time go under the pseudonym Frank Talk, which I haven't been able to figure out exactly what the origins of that are. And it seems like, frankly, a little bit of a lame pseudonym, but it becomes this very famous symbol of the anti-apartheid movement, Frank Talk. Here's just a little snippet from one of those Say So newsletters from the era. It's a poem by Mandlonkose Lunga, and it goes, "The ministers of death pounce, knights in dull shining armor, tear the entrails of the sacred perspiring ebony figure on the street corner. All he did not have was a dumb pass charged with its power of opening permanently closed doors." That's one of my favorite pieces of South African slang, dumpass. D-O-M-P-A-S, which when pressed, black people would say it's a portmanteau for domestic passport, but it literally is dumb pass. The passes are dumb. Excellent. Love it. In 1971, Biko gave a speech titled White Racism and Black Consciousness. We're going to do a document deep dive here because the words of Biko give us the best understanding of why he was such an empowering leader. "A white person possesses the natural passport to the exclusive pool of white privileges. Yet at the back of his mind is a constant reminder that he is quite comfortable as things stand and therefore should not bother about change. I'm not sneering at the liberals and their involvement, neither am I suggesting that they are the most to blame for the black man's plight. Rather, I am illustrating the fundamental fact that total identification by white liberals with an oppressed group in a system that forces one group to enjoy privilege and to live on the sweat of another is impossible. A liberal must fight on his own and for himself. If they are true liberals, they must realize that they themselves are oppressed, and that they must fight for their own freedom and not that of the nebulous they, with whom they can hardly claim identification. In South Africa, political power has always rested with white society. Not only have the whites been guilty of being on the offensive, but by some skillful maneuvers, they've managed to control the responses of the blacks to the provocation. Not only have they kicked the black, but they've also told him how to react to the kick. He's now beginning to show signs that it is his right and duty to respond to the kick in the way he sees fit. The philosophy of black consciousness, therefore, expresses group pride and the determination by the blacks to rise and attain the envisaged self. At the heart of this kind of thinking is the realization by the blacks that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Such a powerful acknowledgement of the psychological impact of racism, something that's so hard to measure and articulate, certainly something that's very hard for me to understand as a white man. But when Biko describes it this way, it gives me an understanding that racism is so much deeper than just what we see on the surface. The Black Consciousness Movement is not only trying to have Black people recognize their inferiority complex, but to recognize that Black is beautiful. Biko is one of the early adopters of this phrase and really helps on a global scale make that phrase become a centerpiece of the Black Power movement of the 1960s and 70s. He said, quote, "When you say Black is beautiful, what in fact you are saying is, man, you are okay as you are. Begin to look upon yourself as a human being." He said at a different time, "It also relates to the way women prepare themselves for viewing by society, the way they dress, the way they make up, and so on, tends to be a negation of their true state, and in a sense, a running away from their color. They use skin lightening creams, they use straightening devices for their hair, they sort of believe that their natural state, which is a Black state, is not synonymous with beauty, and beauty can only be approximated by them if the skin is made as light as possible and the lips are as red as possible." So in a sense, the term Black is beautiful challenges exactly that belief which makes someone negate himself. And so in the United States, and to a certain degree in South Africa as well, the Black is Beautiful movement is played out by Black women wearing the afro, or in South Africa wearing their hair in more natural states, embracing pieces of African identity in their clothing, refusing to lighten their skin or to conform to traditionally white beauty standards. While in Durban in 1970, Biko is going to meet and marry Nitsiki Mashalaba, and she was pursuing her nursing training at King Edward Hospital while Biko was a medical student at the University of Natal. They are going to live a life where Nitsiki is going to be the primary breadwinner in the family for a long time because Biko is going to be a student, and then there's going to be a period of time that we'll talk about where he's going to be banned by the government, and Nitsiki is going to play a really central role in his life and helping support him in a lot of different ways, both emotionally and financially. Biko is going to have accusations of sexism against him, and he's not going to be the most enlightened when it comes to gender politics at the time. He's going to have multiple affairs and children through those affairs beyond the two that he has with Nitsiki, and he's considered a bit of a womanizer. And so why point this out? Well, I think there's some merit to painting a complete picture of an individual. And sociologist Charles Willey said, "By idolizing those whom we honor, we do a disservice both to them and to ourselves. We fail to recognize that we could go and do likewise." Biko ain't perfect. And the fact that he has these flaws in both his politics and his personal life reflect that none of these people that are going to be these great heroes of history are perfect. And we should embrace that fact and understand that that makes them human. They're not beyond humanity. In 1972, Biko is going to be expelled from med school under circumstances which he describes as challengeable. To the best that I can figure out, it seems like he's done with med school and ready to go full-time into a political career. And so now that he's no longer a student, this can't just be a student's movement, right? So in 1972, he helps found the Black People's Convention, which is like the adult version of SASO. And so the BPC and SASO are going to do things like build health clinics, help impoverished squatters, create literacy programs. They're going to have leadership training seminars. They are doing community building. This is the type of stuff that we see groups at the same time contemporarily in the United States, groups like the American Black Panther Party. They're going to be promoting self-reliance through these community programs because they can't rely upon the government or white leaders to take care of the needs of Black communities that are struggling. 1973 is a huge turning point in the life of Biko and his movement because 8 SASO leaders, also associated with the BPC, are going to be banned under the Suppression of Communism Act by the apartheid government. And what the government's going to say is that these leaders are carrying out a so-called Black Revolution. And this is done in direct response to some worker strikes that are happening in Durban that the Black Consciousness Movement didn't even organize. What's really happening is that the government had just finally realized that the Black Consciousness Movement was not in favor of the government's separatist ideals and instead posed a direct threat to their education, economic, and political policies. So this concept of being banned is not a nebulous term. This is a real concept in South Africa. And so what the government would do is, under this law, the Suppression of Communism Act, which is a Cold War era law trying to combat the growth, or rather the perceived growth of socialism and communism in the country. And it relates very similarly to in the U.S. civil rights movement, how the CIA and the U.S. government is going to target civil rights leaders, including people like Martin Luther King, as, you know, communists, which they weren't. So what banning looks like is essentially what happens is Biko and the others are going to be banned for 5 years as they're all sent to their hometowns and essentially put on political probation. And what this meant was that Biko was restricted to the township of Ginsburg in King Williamstown, so he's deported out of Durban. And it also meant that he can't travel, he can't attend a political gathering. The order actually says that he can't do this even if it's a pro-government meeting. He can't instruct pupils. The order specifically prohibits attendance at, quote, any social gathering, that is to say, any gathering at which the persons present also have social intercourse with one another. Thanks for defining a social gathering, you stupid apartheid government. And so Seeso never really recovered from these and immediately subsequent bannings. And so they kind of reached their height in 1973. The government's going to have big crackdowns on their newsletters and printing in general. They're going to be banned from receiving foreign funding. And their lack of leadership, who are arrested or muzzled, is going to lead to, you know, fear of repercussions for people in the broader Seeso and Black People's Convention movement. And, you know, sometimes government repression works in the short term. So Biko being Biko isn't going to follow the ban, right? He's going to enroll in law school, and his response to the banning orders is he's going to set up an office of the BPC in King Williamstown, and he carries out community development initiatives. They build the most advanced community health clinic without government funding that existed at the time in South Africa. He's going to create all these funding sources for students, for political prisoners, and so his banning order gets expanded. He gets banned from meeting with more than one person at a time. He couldn't leave King Williamstown without permission from the police. He's banned from public speaking or writing for publication. And the banning order bans the quoting of Biko, so it is illegal for anyone to quote Biko publicly. So throughout 1974 and 75, he's going to be charged for breaking his banning order by receiving visitors at home. He was found not guilty and acquitted. He's going to be denied a passport to travel to Germany. He's going to be charged with breaking his banning order for entering an educational institution to write a law exam. He's just going to consistently have small ways that he breaks this banning order, gets arrested, gets harassed, and it's all for stuff like he's hanging out with friends or he's trying to take a law exam. There are times where he's trying to meet with other political leaders, but he's just meeting with them and he's going to face all this harassment and arrest from the cops. His wife, Nitsiki, said, "Steve being Steve, really, he wouldn't take the banning order seriously because he would do things done by everybody else. I mean, if he feels like a party, he would go to a party." So, you know, one of these times that he gets banned, he's going to spend 137 days in jail without being charged or put on trial. In July of 1975, nine leaders of Seeso and the BPC are going to be put on trial for fomenting unrest. They are formally charged with treason in October of 74, and this trial is going to last 17 months. Biko is not one of the leaders that is put on trial. Rather, he's called as a witness, and it's the first time he's allowed to publicly speak out after his 1973 banning. And so what happened was, to get them arrested, was they defied a police ban and they held rallies in Durban to celebrate the independence of Mozambique, which got their independence in 1974. And this was called the Viva Frelimo rallies. And Frelimo was the front for the liberation of Mozambique, which is a socialist group. And Biko would actually urge caution to the movement against holding these banned rallies. And so he's not going to be put on trial, but these nine other leaders are. And what the leaders do is they're going to use this to state their case for the Black Consciousness Movement. And so they call this the Trial of Ideas. The state, in turn, is going to use the case to make an example and impose terror and control over their opponents. Historian Daniel Magaziner said, "The trial was more farce than tragedy, and reasoning that some sort of conviction was inevitable, the defendants treated it like theater." So in this bizarre trial, Biko is going to be called to testify for 5 days of testimony. And the way that things work in this courtroom is that the judge, a guy by the name of Judge Boshoff, is going to just get into all of these conversations that he feels like having with Biko. He's not the prosecution, but the judge is just having this like little side conversation with Biko all throughout the trial transcript about things that he's interested in while Biko's under oath. And the judge is very clearly trying to incriminate Biko and the Black Consciousness Movement leaders, and he's very clearly on the side of the government here. Here's a little snippet of the back and forth between the two of them that I'm going to recreate for you.
"Mr. Biko, why do you people pick on the word black? I mean, black is really an innocent reference which has been arrived at over the years, the same as white. Snow is regarded as white, and snow is regarded as the purest form of water, so it symbolizes purity. So white there has got nothing to do with the white man?"
"Right.
But now, why do you refer to you people as blacks? Why not brown people? I mean, you people are more brown than black."
"In the same way as I think white people are more pink than white.
But why do you not use the word brown then?"
"Because historically we've been defined as black people. And when we reject the term non-white and take upon ourselves the right to call ourselves what we think we are, we have got available in front of us a whole number of alternatives, starting from natives to Africans to Kafirs to Bantu to non-whites and so on. And we choose this one precisely because we feel it is the most accommodating."
"Yes, but then you put your foot into it. You use black, which really connotates dark forces over the centuries."
"This is correct. Precisely because it has been used in that context. Our aim is to choose it for reference to us and to elevate it to a position where we can look upon ourselves positively. Because even if we choose to be called brown, there will still be reference to blacks in an inferior sense in literature and in speeches by white racists in our society."
The two then have this ridiculous back and forth about black magic and witchcraft. Biko suggests more scientific research into witchcraft and suggests white people don't have witchcraft, which the judge and his lawyer laugh at and go into what the differences between white and black witchcraft is. It's surreal reading this trial transcript. The judge is trying to get him to say it's stupid for black people to call themselves black because of black magic, black sheep, etc. They go on to just have some back and forth political debates about policing in black communities and the merits of different voting systems. I can't believe this is happening in a courtroom between the judge and this witness. The judge then tried to team up with the prosecution to get Biko to admit that say-so language and actions in the past could have led to a violent revolution in the country by doing things like calling the system of apartheid a system of domestic terrorism against blacks. And Biko beautifully responds by pointing out 50 different ways that language is actually mild to call apartheid domestic terrorism, and says it's consistent with the realities for blacks and that they should be that angry. One more back and forth. This time it's between the prosecuting attorney Atwell and Biko. In this part of the transcript, Atwell is referring to the funeral of Muthuli Kashizi, who was a leader in the BPC who was murdered by being pushed in front of a moving train after coming to the defense of some black women who were being drenched with water by a white station cleaner. Here's what Atwell came to question Biko on.
"Did you attend Kashizi's funeral?"
"I was there, yes."
"Was it an emotional funeral?"
"All funerals are emotional." Well, goes on to try to frame the speeches given at the funeral as aggressively anti-white.
"The speakers brought out all the evil things they could about the whites and ignored all the good that they may or may not be. Would you agree with me?"
"I think they have not finished all the evil."
Dang, that's good stuff. All nine of the Say-So Nine are found guilty under the Terrorism Act and sentenced to periods of imprisonment. 3 for 6 years and 6 for 5 years. They're actually going to be imprisoned at Robben Island, where Mandela is being held at the time. They're found guilty of promoting anti-white feelings, encouraging racial hostility, and preparing for violent revolution. The verdict officially labeled as terrorism, the verbal expression of black anger towards white rule. Biko said, quote, "In a bid for change, we have to take off our coats, be prepared to lose our comfort and security, our jobs and positions of prestige, and our families. A struggle without casualties is no struggle." After his 5 days of testimony,
Biko has to return home for his confinement under his banning, and it turns out that this trial is the last time he ever speaks in public. On June 16, 1976, one of the most famous acts of resistance to the apartheid regime happens in the township of Soweto. Thousands of black students walked out of their schools and marched through the streets to protest Afrikaans becoming the mandatory language of instruction in local schools. This protest is very much sparked by the Black Consciousness Movement. Although not directly planned by Biko, he is certainly a big part of students rising up in this context. Demonstrations are going to spread to other cities beyond Soweto, and across the country, the paramilitary police came out in force, killing hundreds of teenagers and imprisoning thousands. And in this context, just a couple months later, Biko is going to be detained under the Terrorism Act. After spending 101 days at Fort Glamorgan Prison, maximum security section in East London, he's released without even being charged. And heading into 1977, Biko is just going to face constant harassment under his banning orders by the security police. One time he's going to be charged with, quote, defeating the ends of justice, which is kind of like obstructing justice. He's detained and acquitted. He's accused another time of inciting school children, and he's acquitted on that charge. Biko said when the cops asked to see his pass, because he just essentially can't go anywhere, and they asked for his occupation, he would tell them, freedom fighter, just to get a rise out of them. Around this same time, a guy by the name of Craig Williamson works his way into the leadership of the Black Consciousness Movement, and Williamson is a spy of the apartheid regime. And what he's specifically spying on is the Black Consciousness Movement leaders working to secure meetings with international leaders of resistance or securing funding for themselves. And Steve was one of the people planning to leave the country for a meeting, which is obviously against his banning. And Williamson helps expose this. And so the government is going to be out for Biko. And in August of 1977, he and friend Peter Jones are stopped at a roadblock. Biko was rushing home to avoid breaking his banning order again. They were on the way home from a unity talk, actually, with leaders from the ANC and PAC. This is during a point in time where Biko is actually trying to be a mediator and get all the different parts of the resistance movement together. And Peter said, "We came around the corner and ahead was a police roadblock. They pretended they didn't know us. The police officer asked Biko, 'Who are you, big man?' And Biko replied, 'I am Bantu Stephen Biko.' They were arrested, separated." Peter never sees Steve again. Biko's going to be held in room 619 of the Sanlam Building Security Police Headquarters in Port Elizabeth. The building just looks like any old office building. If you look at pictures of it, it's, you know, there's just a freeway directly in front of it, and it looks like a really generic building. And that freeway supposedly deafened the noise and any signs that this building was actually a torture chamber and was beyond just what happens to Biko. So the special branch of the Port Elizabeth security forces that detained him had ties to the Vlakplas, which was the most infamous paramilitary unit of the government that hunted down political opponents for torture and murder. So he's being held under the Terrorism Act, which, much like the U.S. Patriot Act later, allowed for the indefinite detention of anyone the government labeled a suspected terrorist. This is all under false BS pretenses, which we should understand by this point. Police testimonies indicate that Biko's refusal to submit to disrespectful treatment led the police to beat him and run him into the wall. Biko collapsed. Instead of providing medical treatment, the police chained him to a gate in a standing position. They only called in a district surgeon the next day. Despite evidence of brain damage, the police kept Biko naked and chained up in his cell until his condition worsened. September 7th. A doctor is called in by security police head Colonel Goosen to examine Biko, and he asks the doctor for a medical certificate to certify Biko healthy. And the doc writes, quote, "I have found no evidence of any abnormality or pathology on the patient." His condition is so bad, he winds up actually being transferred over 600 miles away to a prison hospital in Pretoria. Or at least that was the plan. On September 11, 1977, Captain Siebert and Wilkin and Detective Sergeant Niewoot threw him naked in the back of a Land Rover to take him to Pretoria. No medical detail with him. Steve dies the next day. September 12th, 1977, at the age of 30, Steve Biko dies of a brain hemorrhage as he's beaten to death by state security officers. Earlier, Biko had said, "It is better to die for an idea that will live than live for an idea that will die." This is where things get really messed up. The police claim that he starves himself to death on a hunger strike. When Biko dies, he's very famous. This can make international headlines. And the Minister of Justice, Jimmy Kruger, testified that it was a hunger strike and that killed him as he goes to testify in front of Congress. He says, quote, "I am not glad and I am not sorry about Mr. Biko. His death leaves me cold. I can say nothing to you. Any person who dies, I shall also be sorry if I die." And Congress erupts in laughter. Man, these terrible people. A few weeks later, Kruger said, quote, "A man can damage his brain in many ways. I've also felt like banging my head against a brick wall many times. But realizing now, with the Biko autopsy, that may be fateful, I haven't done it." Oh, man, these are some evil people. Jeez Louise. According to Biko's friend Donald Woods, the next day Kruger implied that Steve had died of a hunger strike, but I knew this couldn't be true because Biko had once said he would never take or endanger his own life in detention, and that if he were to die in jail and it was claimed he had hanged or suffocated or starved himself or cut his wrists, I was to know it was a lie. So in the coming days, they hold an inquest into his death, and the postmortem showed 5 major injuries to the brain, scalp, lip, rib abrasions, and bruising. However, Magistrate Prinz sided with the regime. He gave a 3-minute ruling that obviously attracted widespread international condemnation of the apartheid government. He said the injuries were sustained in, quote, "a scuffle in the security police offices," and his judgment said, quote, "no one was to blame." The doctors who certified Biko as just fine are actually going to be cleared by the Medical Association of South Africa of having done no wrongdoing. Years later on down the road, they get found guilty, but one was only reprimanded and the other had his license revoked, but then reinstated later. There is no justice in this system. You know, immediately after, a bunch of people linked to the case received promotions at the Port Elizabeth Security Branch, and this isn't the first time this happens. Biko became officially the 46th victim of torture and death under the state security laws in South Africa. Here's a sampling of some of the official causes of death on a list of known deaths in detention under those laws. James Tiitia, suicide by hanging. Ahmed Timol, fell out of 10th floor window. Nicodemus Kigothe, bronchopneumonia following head injuries sustained in shower. Imam Abdullah Haran, fell down a flight of stairs. Fenwell Mogatusi, suffocation. Aaron Koza, hanged himself. Caleb Mayakiso, natural causes. Steve Biko, brain injury. Back to the poem that started our show today. Here's the final lines from Chris van Wyk, a colored South African poet. Here's the lines from In Detention. He hung from the 9th floor. He slipped on the 9th floor while washing. He fell from a piece of soap while slipping. He hung from the 9th floor. He washed from the 9th floor while slipping. He hung from a piece of soap while washing. The excuses from the regime for why these people died might as well have been he hung from a piece of soap while washing. Because we all know why they really died, and it wasn't suicide by hanging, brain injury, or fell down a flight of stairs. One time Biko said, "You are either alive and proud or you are dead. And when you are dead, you can't care anyway. And your method of death can itself be a politicizing thing. So you die in the riots, for a hell of a lot of them, in fact. There's really nothing to lose, almost literally, given the kind of situations that they come from. So if you can overcome the personal fear for death, which is a highly irrational thing, you know, then you're on the way." His wife, Nitsiki, said, "I think Steve expected to die in the hands of the security police. I think all of us expected it. Steve was prepared to sacrifice his life for the black cause." 20,000 people attend his funeral, including the U.S. ambassador and 11 other diplomats. Thousands more are turned away because the police set up roadblocks to stop people from getting there. As 6-year-old Nikosathanathi Biko led the ox cart carrying his father's coffin into Victoria Stadium, thousands of mourners stood up as one with their clenched fists in the air and began to sing the national anthem, Nkosi Sikelel Afrika. Mourners thrust their fists into the air and shouted, Amandla, power, when Steve's coffin was lowered into the grave. A statement from the BPC on his death said, Mr. Biko and other black political martyrs have not died in vain. Despite their deaths, they leave the masses with their unconquerable ideas, which they successfully preach to those who remain. A month after Steve's death, in October of 1977, Seeso and a bunch of black consciousness movements were formally banned, and it became a fully illegal organization. Tons of press organizations are silenced and banned, including Donald Woods. And Seeso stops there. Later organizations like the Azanian People's Organization take up the mantle of black consciousness and Biko's legacy, but these organizations lose out to the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela as the clear leaders of the freedom movement overall, as the ANC is more focused on multiracialism and working together with white people. But the legacy of Biko is he becomes a martyr. He becomes this symbol of resistance. And his death helped draw international attention to the brutality of the regime. It in fact directly led to Western countries supporting a UN resolution to ban arms sales to South Africa, which is part of a whole nother story of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions efforts globally to try to stop apartheid in South Africa. As the African National Congress takes up the mantle of leading the freedom movement, enter into the 90s, and Nelson Mandela is going to be freed from prison. 1994, South Africa has their first truly free democratic elections, and Mandela is named president, and the apartheid era officially ends. They are going to create what's called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission under the leadership of Bishop Desmond Tutu. And in early 1997, this commission is going to meet to try to bring out the truth of what happened during the apartheid era through testimony of people that were directly participating in it and victimized by it, and to try to bring the country together rather than punish everyone across the board. Very difficult thing to figure out after an era of atrocities. How do you create justice? And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is largely going to be based off of granting amnesty in the spirit of forgiveness and reconciliation. So typically what would happen is if you testified and admitted guilt for a crime during the apartheid era as a perpetrator of violence or oppression, you could be granted that amnesty. And so in that spirit, four former police officers appeared before the commission and admitted to killing Stephen Biko 2 decades earlier. And the commission agreed to hear their request for political amnesty, but they actually refused to grant amnesty, which was not the norm, because the men failed to establish a political motive for the brutal killing. But they've never been prosecuted. It's just that they didn't get amnesty. Biko's family is actually still today in the present seeking justice. They're seeking complete answers to what happened. They formed this apartheid-era family victims group to more fully examine deaths of Biko and similar activists. In 2002, Nelson Mandela said, quote, living, he was the spark that lit a veld fire across South Africa. His message to the youth and students was simple and clear. Black is beautiful. Be proud of your blackness. And with that, he inspired our youth to shed themselves of the sense of inferiority they were born into as a result of more than 300 years of white rule. Thank you so much for listening today. Please, if you liked what you heard, you could rate us on Spotify, Apple, wherever you're listening to your podcast. You could subscribe. You can follow us at Daring Dissent on Instagram. And don't forget that ultimately, history is a practice in empathy. Let's finish with a final quote from Biko. We have set out on a quest for true humanity, and somewhere in the distance we can see the glittering prize. Let us march forth, drawing strength from our common plight and brotherhood. In time, we shall be in a position to bestow upon Africa the greatest gift possible, a more human face.